My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner here. So excited to be back with you, having more amazing conversations with amazing humans. Today, we are joined by Michelle Hext, one such amazing human. She is a martial artist. She is a coach. She is a coach to martial artists. She is a best-selling author. She's got three books that I found. And I love the titles, Michelle. I'm just going to say your books, and I don't have them in front of me. I'm remembering, but they're like, one of them is like, How to Be an Elegant Badass or something to that effect.
Yeah, that one is called The Art of Kicking Ass Elegantly.
The Art of Kicking Ass Elegantly. Yeah, they kind of all tie in the martial arts metaphor. But obviously, you do a lot of work with entrepreneurs, talking about some of the nerd stuff that I'm super into, like offer science, creating high ticket offers, how to create coaching and consulting programs with to pair with information products. And like, I love it because you kind of, you know, touch the all the bases, right? Like fitness, performance, entrepreneurship, business. And from everything I can tell, you're like actually a pretty awesome human being too. Thanks for that.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having me today.
Of course. Yeah. Welcome to Unlock Your Potential. So yeah, I want to know, how did you go? Cause you were actually a competitive martial artist, right?
Yeah. I just want to quickly say, I used to exclusively coach, martial arts business owners. Now I'm more mainstream. So I work with female entrepreneurs, but, as far as the, sorry, what was the question?
I was asking about your background back when you used to actually beat people up for a living.
Yeah. So I started Taekwondo a little bit late. So I was in my 20s. I was 22 when I started, almost 23. And I had my black belt within 18 months. I'm the sort of person when I'm in, I'm all in. So I was training 7 days a week with the state team, with our head instructor, our Korean head instructor, as well as at club level. And was state and national champion. My very first fight I lost and I was devastated, but that really planted a seed of what losing feels like, and it sucks. So I was very committed, you know, I was very disciplined about being fight ready every single time, and so many life lessons in all of that. But yeah, I used to fight flyweight. And I had my first fight as a black belt, which is kind of the higher level, 6 weeks after I graded for my black belt. So, and I won. So it was good times.
And this was down in Australia?
Yeah, in Australia. Okay. I live in Melbourne. So, the state of Victoria, which is right down south. So, so that was done there, but, yeah, and I have to say, though, like the WTF is World Taekwondo Federation Taekwondo, and the style of fighting that goes on now since we became kind of an Olympic sport is a bit soft. So back in the day when we used to fight, it was really full contact. So there were knockouts and things like that. Now it's more like tap, tap, tap on the shields, which...
And now it's more of like a point system, right?
Yeah, it always was a point system, but we weren't committed. We were more committed to knocking somebody out than we were just to score points. You know, that was a way to end a fight, because we don't have just one fight in a day. It depends on the division we're in. We can have 3, 4, 5 fights in a day. So it's not like, I know boxing has a lot more rounds, but there are other martial arts where you have one fight. So we used to have a lot. So, yeah.
So if you could end it quickly, you could save your energy for the next fight, basically.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. I like that. Seems like that's a metaphor for life or something. We should apply that probably elsewhere. Okay. So then, I mean, it begs the question, what happened when you were 22 or 23 years old that you decided, whatever I am doing, I'm going to stop and I'm going to go full bore into Taekwondo?
Yeah, well, I hadn't really found my thing yet. So I, you know, I grew up in domestic violence and there was sexual abuse and poverty and things like that, right? And so by the time I was 14, I'd left school and I had a job. And by the time I was 16, I'd moved out of home. And so I, you know, was supporting myself and doing all of those things. And the first big adventure that I went on, I saved my pennies and I went over to the US. So I spent 3 months at the US, in the US, traveling around on my own. I saw 20 states and I just saw a lot. And this is as a 20-year-old in 1989. So there were no mobile phones or internet or anything like that. So it was just traveling old school. And while I was over there, I did, like I mentioned before I before we recorded that, I visited a few national parks in Utah, but all around the US. So I spent a lot of time camping and working, you know, just seeing the forestry officers and the rangers and things like that. And I thought, that's a really cool job. I'm going to go back to school when I go home and I'm going to learn to do that. And so I did. I went back to school at, I was 20. And took myself back and did a diploma of applied science in natural resource management. And while I was doing that, I thought, you know what? I think I want to learn to fly a plane so I can do firebombing and, you know, land surveying from the air and things like that. So I thought, yeah, I'll get my pilot's license. And I was just doing a lot of different things, you know, just trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And then started Taekwondo at the same time. And that was when everything else fell away. It was like, this is my thing. And it just filled so many voids for me. You know, I got to see that, you know, there was something reliable and very structured around martial arts. So growing up in the environment that I grew up in, it was pretty random. And so I knew it was a really fantastic example of goal setting, because the style of Taekwondo that I did had a belt ranking system, right? And you knew that when you started, the first belt was yellow belt one stripe, and they gave you a piece of paper with the syllabus on it. And if you practiced the syllabus and you did it well on grading day, then you passed. And I thought, well, I can do that. You know, I can do that. When I know what I'm dealing with, I can just throw myself into it. And so I did, and I excelled at it. And that's when I really got to understand my strengths through that. And so everything that I've done, like, that was really the foundation, you know, that and travel have been the two things that changed my life very early on.
So it's interesting. And I totally relate, because in my teens, I found music and playing the piano, and that was my thing. And like before that, life didn't make a whole lot of sense. And I kind of felt like I was aimless, and I was in school, but I never really like connected to being in school. But when I found music, it wasn't just, oh, now I have something to do. It was like everything shifted.
Yes.
And suddenly life became about what's possible and what's exciting. And it's like this thing. So I totally get that moment. And I'm curious, and because I even notice on your website and in your process, you talk about like helping people pinpoint their genius. Like, it almost seems like that same thing of like finding your thing. Do you think that like everybody has a thing? Or that like, and you know, I don't think most people are necessarily doing their thing for, at least not for a living.
Yeah.
But do you think there's like a thing in waiting for anyone that'll go hunt for it? Or is it just some people like you and me, we have things, and other people are here to do, you know, I don't know, different stuff.
I think so. You know, I was seeking something, you know, I think you've got to actively be seeking it. Maybe it'll land in your lap. I don't know. But for me, I was seeking something. I knew that I wanted to be passionate about something, and I wanted it to be all consuming. And I knew I just wanted to be lost in something. And that was it. You know, growing up and being a kid, it was, you know, reading and writing. I've been journaling since I was 12 years of age, probably younger, probably 10 actually. And writing, you know, that was just something that I loved to do. And so, but when you asked me that question, I went straight back to this this client that I had. And she was so frustrating. I'm talking about, I don't know, maybe 2014, something like that. And she had this passion for like style and design and things like that. And she was very good at it, very, very good at it. And But she was married to a guy who had a lot of money. And so there was no urgency around it. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes the formula has to be right, right? So she had the gift and she had my support and knowledge and guidance and everything else. We worked together for over 12 months and her website never went off maintenance and she's never done anything with it. And I just think those people will never find their thing, or maybe they find their thing, but they just don't have the courage to go after it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's that intersection, isn't it? It's like you're seeking the thing because you know that there's something that you're supposed to be a part of, or there's something that you're supposed to lead, or there's something that's calling you. You just don't know what it is. But if you're not seeking it, I don't know that you find it. And then I feel like when you, I don't know, I feel like it's got to mean something to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if you find meaning in it and it changes you, like you said, when you found music, it shifted something in you. That shifted something in me that will, you know, and my life was forever changed. And I don't know, I don't think it was because I'd had my childhood the way that it was or anything like that. I think it was like destined for me to find it because that suits my personality 100%. But I think you've got to be looking for it. But do I think everybody has it? Yes. But I feel like some people don't need it like other people.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. That makes a lot of sense to me, I think. And I'm thinking, obviously, there's people listening at some, not right this second, but eventually people will listen to this conversation. I'm always cognizant of those folks listening, our amazing audience. And I'm thinking like, you know, so somebody's listening and they're going, well, but I'm not, do I need a thing? Like I'm, you know, and I will say our show is called Unlock Your Potential. So I tend to think that our listeners are looking for something.
Yes.
Right. What was it? And it's kind of like they say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I almost think it's like it's more than just the teacher. Like the teacher doesn't have to be a person.
No.
The teacher can be a thing.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, I think here's the other thing, right? I think sometimes we try to make the thing sexier or fancier than it needs to be. If you take everything that I do, like over the years, the bells and whistles have been added and it's become more fancy and all the rest of it. But at my core, what I do is help people do exactly what you're talking about, find their potential and leverage it. Like go after it, do something with it. And it used to be in martial arts and it used to be in fitness all those years ago, but now it's in business. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, yeah.
So what would you say? Well, let me back up a step. Who is the typical person that finds you and that you can really, really help?
Yeah, the people that I love are people who, they were kind of like me when I was traveling and wanting to be a, you know, firebomber. It was like, they know they've got potential. They know they've got it. And they know they're looking around. They're seeing other people do big things. You know, maybe they've got the big following. They've got, you know, an offer that is magnetic and people are really excited about it. But usually the people that I work with, like the fame and the, you know, that sort of stuff isn't the driver for them. Impact is. And also this just desire to like unlock the thing that they're trying to figure out. And so often they've well and truly overlooked their sweet spot or their zone of genius. So I've got a guy that just reached out to me, having listened to another podcast that I was interviewed on. And he's a guy that is a coach and he has a very successful kind of one truck like cleaning business. And so that's his niche. And then we got talking and talking and talking. And I said, well, okay, what work have you done before? And how, like, what are the results like? And he's like, oh, well, I took this guy from like $5,000 to $20,000 in like 3 weeks. And I'm like, okay, can you do that again? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, that's it. Like, that's the product. We get to start there. Like we want to, because the people that I work with, they want to be successful. They want to make the money, but they also want to do it in a way that like they feel good about. They don't want to be you know, the used car salesperson on the internet. They want to be the person that has integrity and stands for something and becomes known for the thing that they do really well. And so, you know, now we get to package this up and create this amazing offer around it, and he gets to talk about it. And so that's what it is now. It'll shift. It'll shift and change. But, you know, what they need, the people that find me, all different businesses, all different areas, male, female, different ages. But the thing that they, nothing's fallen into place yet. So they've got lots of ideas, like the typical entrepreneur, right? They've got a lot of different ideas and they start things and then they see the bright, shiny object. And, you know, oftentimes the thing that they, that we settle on is something that we circle back to because it was the idea that they had originally in some form, but they talked themselves out of it. They thought it wasn't good enough or complicated enough or fancy enough, when the path of least resistance is usually the way. The simplest way is usually the way. The uncomplicated way is usually the way. And so I get in there and I clear away all the mess that they've created around the thing, and then we find the thing and then we package it and price it. But the person, there is no one person, but they're people who are in the, you know, the coaching, consulting, mentoring type space.
So one of the things that I've seen you say in multiple places that I've seen it on your website, I've seen it in your social media and so forth, is this idea that, you know, essentially for anybody that helps people or has a heart to help people, which is, you know, what you're talking about, right? Anybody that coaches, not, I mean, a coach is somebody that coaches and consultants help people professionally, but not everyone that helps people does it as a business. Some people just help people, right? But that essentially anyone that has an aptitude for helping people in a certain area is basically one high ticket offer away.
Yes.
From essentially creating the life that they probably want.
100%. And it actually just gave me shivers when you said it, because it's so true. It was true for me and it's been true for so many of my clients. A client that I'm working with at the moment, she just landed an $85,000 package, you know, paid in full up front. Mm-hmm. That's life-changing for her. And she'd been chipping away, you know, but we just nailed the packaging and the pricing and all those different things. And it's like, that's what I'm talking about. Like,
yeah,
you know, oftentimes it might be a $5,000 or a $10,000 or a $20,000 offer that they get to sell on repeat. So that's life-changing in and of itself. But a figure like that for, you know, a single mum who's been, you know, working, you know, she's been successful in her business, but at a certain level, right? And now she's just had this complete breakthrough. Like, people don't earn that in a year. You know, a lot of people don't earn that in a year. So that was, you know, I'm like a proud mama when that stuff happens. I love it.
So when is a person who is helpful, either by disposition or profession, when are they actually ready? And I know, and I'm asking you that, it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek question, because I know that a lot, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs too at different stages. And it's like, there is this reticence or even like outright resistance.
Yeah.
To say, oh, I can't, I'm not ready to charge that much. You know? So my question is, when is somebody actually ready to put together a high ticket offer?
Yeah. When you decide you're ready. Right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can't do that on your own. So sometimes you need to help somebody show you what the value is. So, for example, that particular client will take, she's an e-commerce coach, and she's going to take the business that she's working with from 6 mil to like 9 mil over the next 12 months. And where was I going with that? Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. what was the question?
Well, we have editors, so don't worry about that. But the question was like, when is somebody ready?
Yeah. And so, And so the readiness comes from, just making the decision and then making that decision right. But, you know, not being able to see the value in the offer, like that same client I was just talking about this morning, she was telling me she put out this offer and she was going to charge this. I'm like, have we not had this conversation? Like that you can't charge those prices, especially now that you're getting these results. You need to put the price up. And she's like, oh, this is why I need you. But it's true. A lot of people decide, you know, they're not ready because they're making it personal, and they're also making it about that one client, that what if they don't get the result, right? So when they say, so people will come to me and they're like, okay, I've got my head around the price tag. I get that the value's there. I'm going to make a big promise now. Like, you've convinced me. Yeah, I'm all about it. And then almost every time they'll say, but what if somebody doesn't get a result? And I'm like, well, let me break this to you. In this industry, people don't get results. It happens all the time,
right,
you know, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be your fault. So you can forget about maybe someone won't get a result, because that's going to happen. It will happen. Like, nobody has 100% success rate. Like, if they're telling you that, they're full of it. So, like, it just doesn't happen that way, especially when we're stretching people, because there is that resistance. And yeah. So
what if therapists were like, well, what if they don't get the results? I can't do therapy. Like, you're creating a space of possibility for people to do some damn hard work for themselves. And if they do the work, they can get the result.
Yeah. And in the high ticket space, right? When people are investing in that high ticket price tag, they've got so much skin in the game. It makes your job so easy. So
yes.
The reason I have such great results is because I've got good clients. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so much of the way there, they just don't know it yet, you know. And then when it all starts to, the ducks line up and everything falls into place and we're go, suddenly it all makes sense, you know, and then they get, yeah, like those continued results, and it's fabulous.
So I want to say a couple things in respect to the audience. So earlier you said something about, you were saying to your client, like, oh, you can't be charging those prices. I know the space. I'm an entrepreneur. I know that what you were saying is you can't charge that little.
Yeah.
But I actually suspect somebody might have heard you say that and thought you were referring to, oh, you can't be charging that much to people. People won't pay that. But like, to really understand this high ticket concept as a business owner, people, I want to, even that term high ticket, you and I take it for granted. But basically what we're saying is, creating an offer that allows you to, I'm going to define it, but I'd rather actually you define it. I was going to say that creating an offer that allows you to really lean into the differentiation based on value and quality of delivery, rather than saying, okay, for me to make more money, I need to get more customers because I don't make that much money per customer.
Yeah. I'd rather work with 4 clients and that's it. You know, is like $10,000 US a month, and then I have my group stuff, but for me it's like, how much is enough, you know? And so for me it's like 4 clients is plenty, and the irony is they're so low maintenance, you know, because they don't use you like Google, they use you at the high level.
Yeah.
And you know, gone are the days of, you know, clocking on and making sure that I'm giving an hour's time. You know, some of my coaching sessions are done in like 20 minutes because they're like, got what I needed, off I go. They're busy. They don't have time to be watching the clock countdown. And so when I say, yeah, exactly right. When I say you can't charge those prices, I'm like that is way too cheap. And you know what you're going to attract when you do that.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah.
And you know what you're going to want to deliver.
Yeah.
When you do that. Like, yeah. I mean, if somebody's paying you 10 grand a month, you are going to give everything you can to help them through their issue.
100%. Yeah.
No, I mean, unless you're just a complete, like a thief.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, in that case, God help you. But like for the average person, if I give you 10 grand in exchange for you to help me solve my problem, you're probably going to help me solve my problem, or 100%. At least do everything you can.
Yeah. And my aim is always, for every 10,000 my people invest, I want them to 10x on that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a donation to the Michelle Fund every month. It's like, all right, we've got to get this back. How are we going to make this happen? And so I'm very committed to that. Like, there's not enough coaches that do that, I don't think, where like my number one commitment when somebody signs up is to help them get that return on investment, so we don't have to have that conversation. Like,
right.
And that's how I started getting really good with the pricing and packaging. So I had this product called the 5K formula for coaches, and it was just, I'd been running 12-month programs for a few years, and I thought, what can I do? I want to do short, sharp work. I want to work with people for 4 weeks. And I thought, what can I do in 4 weeks? And what do they need? Like, what is it that, you know, when they come to me that they really need? And it's like, inevitably, like back then, my fee was 5,000 US a month. And the clients would sign up and they'd say, basically, here's my money for the first month. And I want to keep working with you. So like, you know, we need to get this moving. And I'm like, cool. And in my mind, it was very practical. It's like, okay, so I've got to teach them how to, we've got to price and package a $5,000 offer. I'll show them how to sell that. If they sell a couple, they'll pay me and they'll, you know, make some revenue. And people were selling between 2 and 4 in that first 4 weeks. And so that became the, you know, the 5K formula for coaches: create and sell your first $5,000 coaching package in 4 weeks or less. And it was just, I chopped off a part of what I did really, really well, and which was, you know, foundational part of what I did. And a lot of people, as I said, they overlook, like, that was a small part of a 12-month program. And I just, you know, but it became the thing because it was so powerful. So the people that you've got listening, definitely look at that. Maybe you've got this big convoluted process that you're selling, but you really excel in one particular area of it. Focus your attention on that. Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the concepts that I've really been leaning into hard lately, and it's, you know, it's one of the reasons I started a podcast. It's one of the reasons I wrote a book that isn't out yet, but it's like, I don't think information should be that expensive, because I don't think people get that much out of just information. What people need, I mean, what people want ultimately is transformation. They're actually trying to become or achieve something fundamentally different than where they are. But that process, which is an experience, requires so much more than information. And that's where the value is, and that's what you charge for. And I think a lot of times people get hung up and they think, oh, well, like, well, yeah, but what I teach somebody to do, you know, heck, maybe they could get it for free from a YouTube video or something. But like, I promise nobody's out there changing their life with a YouTube video. It just ain't happening.
Yeah, there is that small percentage of the world, right? There's that really small percentage who are just bootstrapping from the start, and they're teaching themselves what they need to know. God, if the YouTube videos and information that's available online was online when I first started online in 2003, like, it would be a whole other ball game, right?
Right.
So, but yeah, I've always said the same thing. Information is not the problem.
Mm-hmm.
People have a lot of information. Implementation is the problem, and the resistance to implementation is the problem. And so, yeah, when somebody asked me the other day, so if I work with you, like, and you know, that's, you know, you charge quite a lot. They knew that already. And they're like, well, you know, could I just do this on my own? I'm like, 100% you could, but will you? Like, you work with me and it gets done. Like, be careful what you say you want, because we're going to make sure it gets done.
Right.
And that's the difference, right? Like, I can have a conversation with someone and give them, okay, if you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things, then that equals the success. One, they don't value it because they haven't invested in it. So they think, oh, that can't be right. There must be something she's not telling me. There must be, you know, but it's not that. It's that. The thing that's missing for most people is not the information that I need to get the thing done. It's like, how am I going to get myself to get the thing done? And then back it up, and then back it up, and then back it up when things don't go to plan. Because anyone can be successful on a good day when the dominoes all fall in the right direction. Mm-hmm. But that's not how it works, right? It's like another setback, and then there's another one, and there's another one, and it's like that classic success, you know. It's like people think success is like that, and it's right. Like, you know, that messy bit in the middle, like, that is the mess. We're in the mess most of the time, and knowing how to navigate that is where having a coach is so important, because they get to navigate that.
Yeah, you said information isn't the problem. It's usually implementation. And I feel like the art of coaching is not just, and as a little bit of context, when I started my education company, which was 3.5 years ago, I guess I did this almost 4 years ago. The very first thing I did was I hired a coach. I have a friend, he knows how to launch information businesses really successfully. He's also my friend. I didn't want to abuse my friendship with him by calling him and asking him a million business questions. So yeah. I said, hey, can I hire you? And I paid him 10 grand a month.
Yep.
And by the way, I've used that information to launch $100 million company. Like, so did I get my ROI? Does coaching work? Yes. So anyway, I give that as contextual background, but I think the real art of coaching isn't just teaching people how to implement. It's actually decoding their resistance to implementing. What's the real reason, now that we've identified what it is that you need to do, but you still didn't do it, what's the real reason you didn't do it? And that, like, do you agree? That's actually, I mean, for me, that's what the coach helped me with the most. It's like, Why am I not doing the thing that I know that I should do?
Yeah, there's definitely a part of that. I used to play a lot in that space, but I feel like it's a lot faster if we just like bypass that for the moment and focus on what we need to do and deal with that along the way. Because you would know this, right? If you so you invested in your coach and you paid that money and you got the result. If you got the result, that solves a lot of problems, right? That solves a lot of resistance getting the result. And so, yeah, resistance is going to come up. It's definitely part of the game. Like, we have to just expect that it's there. And the more that we can prepare our clients for shit is going to go wrong all the time, just be prepared for that. I'm not saying that because, you know, I want you to have this experience of things going wrong, because things can go right too. But how you handle and how long it takes you to get back up after you have something not work out the way you want it to is going to be the difference. Like, this is the skill of resilience that we're building. And this is what makes you a robust and resilient entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones that are successful like yourself, like before you did that launch, how many failed launches along the way were there? You know, probably a lot. And it's having the coach. Definitely, you know, for me, I think it works more rather than like sitting there and unpacking the why. Mm-hmm. We used to do that. Now it's more about what do we want? How are we going to do it? And then if somebody's resisting, I'm like, okay, what's going on? And we deal with that little bit of resistance in the moment. And the way I see like coaching, like my particular style of coaching, it's like I'm the snow plow, right? My client is the runner that's got to get from A to Z. And on this road, and I'm just the snow plow, like moving the snow out of the way so they can keep running. Like the snow's the resistance. And so when we clear that out of the way, it doesn't mean that I've got to clear the entire road before they start running. I'm just clearing a little bit ahead, and it makes no difference, right? By the time they get to where they want to go, they've dealt with the resistance. They've learned how to like meet it head on and do it anyway and things like that. So yeah, probably a little bit different perspective for you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Hey, sorry for the interruption. I just wanted to let you know you can get a free copy of my book, The Millionaire Shortcut, which shows you the fastest way to become a millionaire in the new economy. And there's a special link just for this episode in the description. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the episode. I didn't require a whole lot of deep exploration. Usually, if I was resisting something, it was a fairly quick solve. And then I would go do it. And I take your point. Like, you don't want somebody paying you to spend a month talking about their relationship with their dad.
Yeah.
And why they're scared to make a phone call. You want to talk about that for 5 minutes and say, okay, great. Now, like, let's make a phone call.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's interesting. These days, I don't really even have a lot of those conversations. I used to, though. And then I remember just feeling like, this is draining the crap out of me. And, you know, my first book was very much, it was called the Bulletproof Confidence and a Kick-Ass Body Through Martial Arts Training and Principles. That was the first one. Actually, I think it was the third one, The Art of Kicking Ass Elegantly, where I spoke about my story. No, I think it was the first one. Sorry. I spoke about my story, like the childhood trauma and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I attracted a lot of people who wanted to talk about that in the coaching sessions. And then I just made a decision. I'm not a life coach and I'm not a counselor, and I have compassion and I'm very willing to have conversations, but I make it really clear if I feel like they need to go and speak to somebody about it, that's not my role. And if that's the sort of stuff in a, most people don't come to me though, but so for example, if I was running a sales call and somebody started talking about, you know, their childhood and how difficult it was and all the rest of it. I'm definitely compassionate about it, but I'm going to say, okay, with all of that in mind, what feels like a priority? Working on that stuff or building your business with me and, you know, kind of dealing with that stuff as it comes up, but that can't be the focus of the work that we do together. And they're like, no, the business is good. And it kind of snaps them out of it. It's like, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Like this actually doesn't have to be part of this. And for me personally, separating my story from my capability as a coach was so empowering, you know, because, you know, as a child who grew up and had all those things happen and all that sort of stuff, it's like you view yourself a little bit differently, you know, like a little bit broken or a little bit second class or, you know, whatever it is, right? The person with the story. And I just stopped talking about it one day and I stopped writing about it. I stopped, like, there's references because it's part of who I am and I would never hide it. But it's like now it's like this much and the success of my clients is this much. It used to be like maybe half and half. And then, you know, that day it was like, why am I attracting this? And I'm like, oh, this is why I'm attracting this, because I'm talking about it all the time. And so I just had to make that shift. And now my work feels very clean. It feels very strategic. There's a human element, of course, because people have human stuff. The entrepreneurs that I'm working with are humans, but it's very clean and it's not muddying the waters of me feeling like I'm a life coach, because I'm not. I can be a good friend and I can be a support in that way, but I'm not a life coach. It's not what I do.
Yeah. That's really interesting. The extent to which you get what you attract, basically, and you get what you put out there. And even on this, you know, in this conversation, you referenced it really only to kind of briefly explain why you were out on your own at 16. That was just context, right? It wasn't like we spent a lot of time there. You didn't evidence any real desire to like sit in it and like talk through it or anything, that's really cool. So let me ask this. What would you say is the difference? Like you said, nobody gets 100% success outcomes, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had a client that didn't get the result. Yeah. Would you say is the difference or differences between your best clients, or let's call them your most successful clients and your least successful clients?
Yeah. The most successful clients are the ones who, I don't know, I think maybe they've been in my world a little longer and they understand me, that like they know my boundaries are very, very strong. It's almost like they're ready. They're a little bit scared, but when they come, they're ready, like they're really ready and they know what they're getting themselves in for. And when we have that conversation at the beginning, there's usually no sales calls. They just drop into my DMs and like, okay, how much is it going to cost? When can I start? And I'm like, cool, maybe we should jump on a call and just, if I don't really know them very well. But the difference is really that they're very, very ready and they really trust and believe that I'm going to get them the result. You know, they trust the process and they will say things like I'm in your hands, I'm going to do whatever you think is right. And for me, that's not like, do it like I do it. It's me like unpacking what's the right thing for them. And the ones that don't get the result, they don't have the urgency for the result. And I want people who are as hungry for the result as I am. You know what I mean? It's like,
Okay. So, God, I have like a swirl of questions. Actually, can we connect some dots first?
Yeah.
But how did you get from martial arts into coaching?
Yeah. So martial arts is coaching, right? It's just a different kind of perspective.
Right.
So I'd been doing my martial arts since 1991. I had my first school, my own solo school, by the time it was maybe 93, something like that. And I was running my own schools and things like that. So that had all happened. And then I was starting to, personal training started to become a thing. And I thought, oh, I'm going to add that to my business. So I went and like, we're talking correspondence course because I've just had a baby. And when I'm talking correspondence, I'm talking about write it out. In
oh, yeah.
Getting, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, like you have to like mail in your assignments, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I had to decipher my hieroglyphics. Anyway, so that was it. And then, so I was running my martial arts school. I was running some group fitness and PT and things like that. I developed an exercise, like a martial arts to music product called Power. And it was like a Tai Bo type thing. So I recorded, you know, DVD like videos, mm-hmm. and I sold that through martial arts magazines. So that became a product. It had a workbook, like a manual and stuff like that. So I did that. And I always had like innovative ideas back mm-hmm. then, or even now. And so I was doing all of that. And then life coaching and business coaching became a thing. And I thought, oh, this sounds like something I'm really interested in. And this would have been in 1999. And so this course came to my awareness. It was called Results Coaching Systems. And David Rock was the founder, incredible, incredible guy. And so I did that training and it was like Taekwondo was, this was made for me. It was like, oh, this is what I do. This is what I do. And so I got a little bit messed up because I tried to follow this syllabus and tried to do sales call the way that they scripted them, and I sucked at it so bad. But I got creative, you know, and I remember at one point I had my Taekwondo school on one side of the street and I had my business coaching offices on the other side of the street. And I had been, you know, had really good relationships with the local papers because of my Taekwondo school. Every time we graded or somebody won a tournament or whatever, they would always do a write-up and I advertised in them. And so when I launched my coaching business, I went to the local paper and I said, hey, I would like a 13-week column in your paper, please, because I want to do a coaching series in the paper. I want a column. And they're like, sure. So I would type it out. I would walk down to the office, hand over my typed up piece of paper so that they can put the column in. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I was going to promote an information evening through the column, you know, just a little bit at the bottom. And so I had an information evening, and yes, that was, I sold out my first group coaching workshop and my first clients came from there. And I've always, you know, I had my Taekwondo school back then and I had a head for business and, you know, thinking outside of the box and things like that. And so, I ended up just gravitating towards a business side of things and performance-based stuff as opposed to life coaching stuff. And then that evolved, you know, as I went along and I developed a martial arts school. I opened one and it was women's only. So it was adult women's only dojang and our walls were pink. And I marketed it as a 4-week absolute beginner program. That was our only way to entry into the school. And the brochure was not the usual martial arts marketing. It was a woman standing there with abs and her hands by her side. And she had hot pink gloves on, boxing gloves. And she had these little hot pink shorts on. And I said, if you think boxing's a great idea, you should try this. If you think boxing's a good workout, you should try this. Mm-hmm. It blew up. The marketing was so different. And I was targeting people who were already of that mindset. And that school was at capacity within 6 months. I'd never had such growth so quickly. And the environment was just something that makes me cry today to think about it, because it was such an empowering environment for these adult women who were, you know, they really needed it. And the reason I opened that school is, you know, over all of my years of training and having schools, it's like the people that really need it are a lot of women, and they don't go because they're intimidated by the men. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to start a school with just the women. Like, let's just see how that goes. And it was perfect. And so my first high ticket offer was when I wrote my second book, which is called The Honorable Martial Arts Entrepreneur. And that was me teaching them how to niche and market to that niche. So how to create exactly what I did, but based on their niche. So some martial arts school owners, you know, love teaching teenage boys who become fighters. Mm-hmm. Other martial arts schools love teaching, you know, bullied teenage girls. Others, you know, there's a certain mm-hmm. student that just elevates you. When they're on the mat, you're a better instructor. You just want that a whole class of that student. And so that's what I had. That's what I created. And I got to charge a premium for that. And so I taught people how to do that. So that was the very first high ticket offer. And then I'd been working in that space. You know, I did the thing. So I had the funnel going. I had this perfectly poised five-part video series that was so good, probably over-delivered on value. I wrote the book and I launched it as a digital course, as an online group coaching program, as an in-person mastermind. And I really loved working in that space, but something just shifted. And I just remember looking up one day and thinking, I have to work pretty hard to get them across the line, like, because they're not investors naturally. They're not business people. They're martial artists who find themselves in business and they don't see the value of investing. And so while I did have some amazing clients, I just remember thinking, I'm pushing shit uphill here a little bit and I think it could be easier. And so I just made the decision, you know what? I'm going to go with female entrepreneurs, service-based female entrepreneurs. And suddenly it was like, take all my money. Mm-hmm. Like everything that I released, people just wanted it. I'm like, what the hell have I been doing for the last X amount of years? And it just shifted everything because the market was just so much bigger and more willing to invest. They were used to investing. They were female entrepreneurs. So that's how I ended up here. And then it's just been an evolution of what I've been doing ever since.
You know, I love your story. I'll tell you what I love about it is, you know, if somebody meets you today, doesn't know, you know, just kind of sizes you up, hears you, maybe watches you work a little, maybe follows you to your, not in a weird way, but just like sees where you live. Like they're going to go, this is a really successful person. This person like has it all. They have the life, they have the business, they have like, right. And, you know, take that as a compliment. I certainly mean it that way. But what I love is it's not like you didn't like invent the Frisbee or like start CrossFit or like even Taibo. Like you did a video training thing, but it didn't blow up as big as Taibo did. Like I've heard of Taibo. I haven't heard of the thing you did. Like you're a really great example of a person that has stitched together, you know, a modest win into a little bigger win, into a little bigger win, into a little bigger win that ultimately compounded over time. You know, again, to the person that doesn't know you from Adam, you might look like you're the CEO of Netflix or something. Like, we don't know, right? And it's a great example of how I think people in their minds so often they have this idea of entrepreneurship as like, I'm going to grind and it's going to suck. And I'm going to pay my dues and then I'm going to hit my home run.
Yes.
But honestly, you've hit singles, doubles. The stage got a little bit, you started in single A, went to, I'm using an American baseball metaphor.
Yeah, now
you're swinging in the big leagues. Like it doesn't have to be, you know, it really humanizes entrepreneurial success. I think that's what I like so much about your story.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think the thing for me is I just followed my nose and my passion. Yeah. When the passion started to dim, it's like, I can't keep doing this. It's like, it's like computer says no, you know, when I'm done,
right.
I'm not enjoying, if the passion's not there, it's like, I've got a window here. I've got a shift because it will decline because I'm not somebody that can work from a place of just going through the motions. I've never been that person. Like I turned 53 on Monday. So I've been on the planet a long time and my enthusiasm and passion for the things that I do is still the same as it was on day one, only more because I've got to see what I can help people produce, you know, and even though those wins were small and small, and small, they felt massive.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
when I launched the Honorable Martial Arts Entrepreneur, I had a launch. And it was when I ran a one-day event and I sold people into that high-ticket mastermind. And I did like around $30,000 that day. And I hadn't made that much in a day ever, right? This is 2012. Like this is a long time ago, right? 10 years ago. And so then when I launched my 12-month mastermind after that in the female entrepreneur space, that day I did 200,000 and we're talking a space of 18 months, you know, but the 30, I was happy, you know, and then I had revenue coming in and things like that. And I was like, I've made it. I've so totally made it. But then, you look around and you're like, oh no, there's another level, you know? And then you just, because we're innately growth seeking individuals, right? And so we're looking for the next thing. And it's not because they're doing it, I want that. It's more about exactly what your podcast is about. It's like, I realize there's more, I've got more in me. There's more potential here. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen it. Now I've seen the mountain. Now I have to climb it. There's just no other option. And so it hasn't been this strategic thing that one day I started out as a martial arts school owner and I knew I'd end up here. No way. It's just that I followed my passion, and I didn't just follow it. I did the work, you know. I didn't just sit around thinking about it. It was like, it was half done by the time I left my chair, you know, had the idea. And it's like a lot of things are in place in the first hour of me having an idea. And
let's pause on that.
Yeah.
Because if you asked me the question of my most successful students, whether they're people purchase a course, people I've coached, people in my mastermind, whatever, most successful versus least successful, that would be my answer. It's the people that take massive, almost instantaneous action.
Yeah.
So because totally selfishly, because I want to know the answer so that I can force feed it to everyone in my world.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? How'd you get that way?
I think it's in my nature.
Okay.
I really do.
That doesn't particularly help me, but okay.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, I'm an impatient individual by nature, right? But I think it's a learned thing, right? I remember, you know, as a teenager and stuff like that, I had very low self-esteem and I would say no to so many things. And I'm thinking back now, I remember I must have been about 16 or 17 and I was dating this guy and we ended up as freaking like president and secretary of the Young Farmers Association or something. He was very driven. And I remember saying yes to that. And suddenly, you know, I had a role and I had to elevate to that role and I loved it. And then I started to say yes to different things. And I think it started from saying yes when I wanted to say no. And then just, it was almost like every time I was walking to the edge of the cliff and jumping off and going, I'm sure it's going to be all right. You know, just like, I'm just going to go and see what happens. And I think that that becomes something that you train into yourself. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's just something that I've developed over time. And now it's almost like a formula. So I went through this stage in about 2016 and 2015, I think it was, where I went through this phase where I would just have an idea for a product and it would be selling within an hour. The sales page would be built, the copy would be written, the PayPal button was hooked up. And I took my business to the stratosphere, just selling those off-the-cuff offers. And the energy around launching, having the idea for an offer, getting so excited as I'm creating the page and then throwing it at the internet and seeing people wanted it. Sometimes it was 10 people, other times it was 3 people, but I didn't care because I just wanted to do it. And I was building it, you know, recording it and building as a digital course for consumption later and things like that. But that was me really just honing this idea that, and I guess observing that there are so many of those ideas that I hadn't did nothing with. And ideas don't make you money.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The product does. And so I just got better and better and better. And so now I've had to come back a little bit, right? So I've got this product that's launching at the moment. And I decided that I was going to launch it in January. And I'm still screwing around with it because, well, it's the doors opened yesterday. But it was one of those things where it's like, no, this feels like a really big deal and I'm going to take my time with it. Yeah, the copy was there and I have to go back to that original energy when I first downloaded it and just remind myself, oh yeah, this is the thing. This is amazing because too much as time has passed from the initial idea to the launch, but I can get back there now, you know? And so I think, yeah, we want to be able to take action quickly because we need to get that skin in the game. And it's just, I think, a discipline to do it. Mm-hmm. And knowing yourself enough to know how much skin do I need to have in the game so that I know this is actually going to continue. because you can be out, you know, if you like me, I go for a walk each day, and I, you know, I live by the ocean, and like, I'm like in my thing, like, don't forget about this thing. Don't forget about, like, 27 ideas come up, and I come back, I sit at my desk, and I like create some sort of order, and I'm like, that's what I've got to do today. And I just do it. I don't think about it anymore. I think too many ideas die on the table because we don't take action. And mm-hmm. so if you weigh up the difference between, you know, think back, like yourself or whoever's listening, think back to that idea that you had and you thought that was the most incredible idea, and then you talked yourself out of it, and then you see 27 other people doing it now and killing it, and you're like, oh, I had that thing, and then you tell yourself it's too late, and then no, because other people are already doing it now, and then it becomes nothing. And so, like you said earlier, right, you didn't invent the Frisbee or anything like that. And so where I thought you were going with that comment, and what I love so much about our business, is everything that I've created started here. It started with me and my journal, and suddenly something pops up and it's like, oh shit, that's the thing. And I got to create a whole business and life around being able to unpack what goes on in here in the form of products, coaching-based products. And that's the most exciting part about our industry. You got to act on it. You got to act on it.
Yeah, it's really interesting and sort of ironic if you think about it. You know, I think a lot of times people have an idea and maybe they take action on it, maybe they don't, but they don't see it all the way through.
Yeah.
And the reason a lot of times people don't is this sort of general, it's like a combination of fear and like this sort of delusion of efficiency that, like, well, it's probably not going to work out, so why would I spend? I don't want to waste the time. Or it's probably not going to work out, so I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to look foolish, right? And so they don't take action on it because they don't want to take action on it and have it not work out. So let's say you have 10 ideas. And in your mind, you're like, I'm not going to take action on them because they might not work out. Well, now you guarantee that 10 of them won't work out, all 10. None of them can possibly work out because you're not taking action. You might take action on 10 and have 9 of them fail completely. And actually, and I think that much is obvious, and go, oh, one success. Yeah. What if all 10 fail?
Yeah.
You're no worse off than if you didn't do, actually, you are worse off. No, you're better off than if you had just not taken action, because then you still have 10 failures to even start, and you didn't learn anything.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of people who think that failing publicly is worse than not trying privately.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think we've got to normalize that failure thing, right?
Yes, that's what I'm actually saying. Yeah. Let's clap for people when they try.
Yeah, so I'm really transparent about it. It's like, for every freaking offer that succeeds, there's a lot that die somewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's just talk about the dot-com graveyard, like the domain, the domains that you've got as long as your eye, because everything needs a domain. You know, so many things fail, but you don't get to have the $30,000 day or the $200,000 launch by not doing those other things first. And the failing thing is critical. Like, it's so important. And you don't know where you're going to end up until you start trying. And that's the one thing that I wish everyone would just hear me when I say. It's like, you've got to stop waiting for the right time. You just got to make now the right time. And it's not going to be perfect. And it's okay, because the next one might be, or this might be, you know, who's perfect is, you know, it's a joke anyway, really, but right. It's like, stop giving yourself reasons not to have a go. Like, just go for it. There is nothing to lose. And I think that's the thing that I've always had going for me. I've had nothing to lose from day dot, you know, when I, you know, left school early and all that sort of thing, anything that I've had a crack at, it's like, I got nothing to lose here. So I'm just going to have a crack and see what happens. And, you know, there's so much that comes into it with fighting as well, right? So when you're fighting, like combat, and you're sparring somebody or you're fighting. And when you get hit is when you half-ass it and you're like, oh, I think I'll go for it, but what are they going to do? And you're thinking about getting hit. But when you go, this point is mine, and you just go for it, you score every single time, and you often don't get hit because you're just following it up because you've made space to get in there. And so for me, like fighting, it's perfect for business, right? Because if you've ever done it, if you've ever sparred or anything like that, you know that when you hesitate and think about what the other person's going to doing, and maybe I'm going to get hit when I do this, you get hit. Mm-hmm. But when you're fully intentional, when you're like, I got this, and you just go for it and you don't give yourself too much time to think about it, they don't have time to think about it. And then you score the point. And it's the same with business. You know, did I get hit sparring? Yes. You know, but every one of those times, I remember every one of those times where I'm like, this is mine, I got it. Like there was just no debate going on because I was so intentional. And we've got to be like that about our business as well. We've got to take it seriously. So we can't be saying, you know, this idea may not go anywhere. You have to, you know, believe that this is the best idea that ever happened and treat it that way. You know, don't treat it like, oh, well, it's just my idea. So it's like, this may be the thing. This may be the Frisbee. And so you've got to treat it that way. It's important. It's important work. And people just don't take it seriously enough and they don't make it important enough. And so they don't value it, so other people don't value it. So you've got to value what you do.
I think you just punctuated this conversation with such an important point that if you don't value what you do, not only will other people not value what you do, it's actually ridiculous for you to even want them to.
Yeah.
Right? Like yeah. It actually doesn't even make sense. So okay, only because sadly, we actually are out of time. This conversation has flown by. I can't believe we're actually out of time. I think you've got this conversation and anybody listening at this very good kind of buildup of energy. Like I'm ready. I want to have an idea just so I can go take massive action right now.
Yeah.
I've already got too much to do. So if people want to follow this thread and go find you and get more, whether it's inspiration, whether it's coaching, whether it's curriculum, whatever, tell them where to go.
Yeah, so you can go to my Instagram, Michelle Hext. My website is also Michelle Hext. And I've got a podcast called the High Ticket Coaches Podcast. So I don't interview or anything like that. It's just my thoughts. I don't even have an intro and an outro anymore. It's pretty low key, but it's, you know, more of this theme.
On that podcast, do you get into some of the nerdy stuff about high ticket offers and pricing and sales strategies and fulfillment and like the mechanics of the business?
Sometimes it is. And sometimes it's more about the human underneath the offers, you know. Ooh. And help get to the point where, like, you know, I say I'm not a life coach and I'm not, but I know how people work and I know what stops them. And so I talk about the resistance, definitely talk about the resistance. There's some strategy stuff. There's some behind the scenes stuff. I'm very, you know, honest about things. So recently I just did a launch and I was trying to get Facebook to spend quite a lot of money every day and it wouldn't, you know, with the ads.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, the leads have gone from like, you know, $7 last year to, you know, they were looking like $50 a lead. It was just ridiculous. So I spent the budget. It wasn't great. I should have had thousands of people come through my 5-day challenge. I had 250 and I had like 10 people show up on the actual live call. And it just freaking sucks. You know, it sucks, but I talk about it and I'm like, you know, that's something that I'm annoyed because it should have worked, but also it didn't. And I also know that, okay, so there are now 250 new people in my world and they may not buy this offer and they may not be paying attention just yet, but they're on my list. And it takes one client, like it'll take one client to cover the cost of that ad campaign or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so so I unpack my thinking around failure, you know, I unpack it and it's like, this is my thought process when this goes on. So you can think the same way. Don't ask me what I did and what I didn't do. Ask me how I thought about it, because that's going to be the thing that changes it for you. you know, when things don't go to plan, you got to think about how to reframe it quickly and how to leverage whatever, you know, and leverage and salvage whatever you can from what you've got.
Sounds like a really, honestly, really interesting podcast. I might actually have to tune into that one. That's the psychology of, so my friend Alex Hormozi calls it psychological solutions. He basically says, people tend to get very fixated on logical solutions. You know, how do I solve the problem by trying this or trying that? But usually the tip, and especially the bigger the problem, the less logical the solution and the more psychological the solution. It's going to be about changing the way you think about the problem, not trying to find another answer on the basis of how you're already thinking about the problem. That's kind of what I heard you just say. And I think it sounds super fascinating. Okay. Well, listen, we're going to get all those links. We're going to put them in the descriptions. We're going to send everybody we can your way. Thank you, Michelle. This has been incredible. Thank you for the work you do. Thank you for the conversation we just had.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.